It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
What if I told you that most of what you've heard about baby sleep is wrong? Well, we're going to be separating myth from science because your baby isn't broken, you're not failing, and better sleep starts with understanding what's actually normal. Today on Sleep Science Today, we're going to be talking with Heather Boyd. She is an occupational therapist, infant and family sleep specialist, and mom of three. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Heather, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Well, baby sleep is certainly an important thing. Everybody starts off as a baby. We all experience it, and none of us remember it, I'm sure. We were too young at the time. But tell us about yourself. Tell us about how does an occupational therapist get into the business of baby sleep?
Well, I'm sure there's more than just the way that I got in, but I got in as an occupational therapist who became a mother of a baby who was not sleeping very well at all, who broke all the rules about everything I thought that sleep was supposed to be, about what I thought my role was in teaching sleep, and how it was all going to unfold. And I know for most of us, when we become parents, we hear how exhausting it is, especially that newborn stage. I don't think anyone can really prepare you fully for how exhausting it can be. And then when you have a baby who's not even sleeping the way that, you know, you're expecting at all. If the wake-ups are every 20 to 30 minutes, then you're left feeling like you have a baby that hasn't read the book. Like, darn it, they should have read the book. They had 9 months to read the book on baby sleep, and they didn't. And then you have all the stories in your head of what you're supposed to do, that it is your job to teach them to sleep. And something didn't fit right for me, both as an occupational therapist who had worked with babies for years. I never really worked with sleep, never really appreciated how exhausted the clients I was working with were. And so once I became a mom and was this tired, I started looking for something that was going to fit better with what I was getting to know of my baby and how that was going to fit in with what I knew about infant development, even though sleep wasn't something that I had a lot of knowledge in.
Okay. So let's kind of take this from the beginning. So prior to you ever having a child, you're getting prepared for your first child. Obviously, you know that that's something that's coming about, but you've, you know, never dealt with babies or sleep from your own perspective. So what did you do prior to giving birth, if anything, to prepare for how you were going to handle this new person in your life?
I knew that breastfeeding was often harder than anticipated, and that was a hurdle that I expected to have. And I knew that preparing for labor was going to make a difference. So I could have had a PhD in birthing babies and a PhD in breastfeeding, or at least through the parenting perspective, but sleep I did not touch at all. I had this vague kind of awareness that sleep was going to be an expected challenge. But I did no more research on it than that whatsoever. It was like being in the clouds when it came to sleep. I focused much more on giving birth and on preparing for breastfeeding. Didn't even touch the sleep thing at all. So I think that's part of why it hit me like a Mack truck when it wasn't going well.
Right. Okay. So you give birth, you bring the baby home. How had you set up for the baby sleep? I'm assuming you had somewhere that the baby's going to be sleeping. Was that in your room? Was that somewhere else? How did you prepare?
Yeah, well, we had the crib. And by that point, I knew that the ideal is for baby to be in the same room as the parents for at least the first 6 months. That reduces the risk of SIDS. It allows for higher rates of breastfeeding because you're closer to your baby. And it becomes easier to respond to your baby in the middle of the night. But we had a room that didn't really fit the crib, so we started with a little Moses basket. And we had one of those broad IKEA headboards. I don't know, the Malm, I think. And the bassinet or the little Moses basket fit right on the headboard. So we had baby on the headboard for the first few months in this Moses basket. And that worked reasonably well, other than having to, like, when the Moses basket's on the headboard, you still have to get up and crawl up the headboard to respond. But it was working okay when sleep was at the newborn stage and it was just kind of reflexive, right? Babies sleep around the clock. They don't know day from night. When they wake up, they generally need to be fed. They fall asleep without any effort. But as he moved out of that stage into a little bit more awareness of the world around him, he became aware that sleep wasn't so pleasant for him. So he wasn't very interested in it. So that's how it started in our room, on the headboard of that IKEA bed, in a little Moses basket until he had outgrown it.
Okay. And hopefully you have photographs of this so you can use it to embarrass him at his wedding.
That's a good point. I'll have to start looking for them now.
So you said at some point your baby started to become aware and then sleep started to become an issue. Roughly how old are we talking for your particular experience?
Oh, you know, it really is a blur because, of course, even with typical newborn sleep, it's one of the most difficult things, I think, of becoming a parent is just how interrupted your sleep is. You're recovering from one of the most intense 9-month periods you could ever have. Mm-hmm. The intensity of delivery and all the hormones that come with that and adjusting to this new role, which for the first time I was not working or going to school. I was at home. And as an aside, I had all these ambitions of what I would get done. I thought, if I'm home full time with a baby, maybe this is the time of my life where I get to learn to play guitar, which was way off course. I had no time. I did not pick up the guitar the whole mat leave, Andrew. It was not on the roster. when I wasn't doing something baby related, I was probably trying to catch up on some rest. And so I would say, you know, generally, and I can't remember specifically for him, but for my clients, that 3 to 4 month mark is where the light bulbs start going off. So if I had to take a guess, it was probably around that time, which was also around the time that I took my very first outing away from my baby. So I remember that was at about 3 months. Left him with my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law to go watch an opera, which I'd never done before. Oh, wow. And it was lovely to get away. But that was that 3-month mark. And I remember it because my sister-in-law, who is loving aunt, but far less tied in her identity to whether my baby is going to sleep or not. Mm-hmm. So my baby fell asleep right on her while we were gone quite easily, much more easily than me. Because as a mom, I felt really responsible for getting him to sleep, which means my stress level's up here. Right. And when it comes to sleep, stress and sleep do not make a very good fit. So I would say it was probably around the 3-month mark. And at that point, I was like trying to catch up on all the reading and studying I didn't do about sleep when I was pregnant. And so I was reading Harvey Karp's The Happiest Baby on the Block. I was reading The Baby Whisperer. I was reading all the conventional books and trying to follow them to a T, which meant a lot of hands-on work to get him to sleep because I wanted him to sleep instead of looking at what does he need to be able to sleep. Right. And so with Harvey Karp, we were doing the padding and the shaking and the shushing and the swinging, and it worked kind of, except I think it was probably just a coincidental byproduct of me putting all this time into helping him sleep. And so a lot of energy was going into sleep because I needed him to sleep more than he needed to sleep.
Right. Right. So when you described that, you know, he was starting to become aware and sleep was starting to become this issue, was it like, what was he doing that led you to think, something's off?
Yeah, it was the frequency of wake-ups in the night. Now, by this point, I'd begun to understand that this elusive sleeping through the night was not a short-term project. This is something that takes months to get to. So it was dawning on me already, these expectations I had about sleep were not a match with what biological, normal sleep development looks like. And on the other hand, he was waking up even more than what the biologically and developmentally in line guidelines would tell you. So he wasn't measuring up to the conventional, your baby should be sleeping through the night at 6 weeks. And he wasn't even measuring up to, and it wasn't like he was doing something wrong. He just wasn't sleeping as long or as deeply as you would expect if sleep was unfolding naturally. And so I still recall in desperation trying to just see if things were improving from night to night, because it was frequent wake ups. And so I still remember in the dark, because I didn't want to turn on a light, because I knew light would influence melatonin. I didn't want to wake him up. In the dark, I couldn't even see. I'd have these scraps of paper and I'd be writing the time intervals between wake ups. And if it was like 2 minutes longer than the last wake up, I'd think, okay, it's getting longer. It's improving. And looking back now, I think, no, that's statistical noise. Like that's right. Not an improvement. That's just, you looked at the clock 1 minute later than last time. But it was like scraps of paper with these 25 to 35 minute intervals of wake ups. In the end, if I'm going to jump ahead, he had reflux that was undiagnosed for quite some time. Oh. And so we were under treating reflux, despite my knowledge as an OT, because there's one thing that you alluded to at the beginning, Andrew, which is the OT hat and the mom hat are very different hats. You can't be an OT for your own baby. And So any of the concerns I had, my thinking brain would kind of dismiss it, or I'd mention it to the doctor and he'd dismiss it too. And then we'd carry on with these little scrappy bits of paper with 30 minute sleep intervals on them. And so it was, yeah, exhausting and trial by fire, really, that led me to wish that I had gotten different support at that point in my mothering, that really did lead me to end up turning my whole OT private practice towards sleep specifically.
So it sounds like really the only support that you had was your own reading of books and maybe talking with the pediatrician?
Yeah, well, in Ontario, we tend not to have pediatricians unless there's something specific wrong. So it was our GP. Because sleep can be so variable and so fragile early on, it can be very easy to dismiss it as just normal sleep challenges. Mm-hmm. But even without the reflux, I think just the challenge of being a sleep-deprived parent with fragmented sleep because a baby naturally wakes up often is one that requires support just to help parents get through feeling less terrible, less worried, less anxious, less feeling like they're doing something wrong. So even without the reflux, I think the messages and support that I could have gotten to help me through would have made a bigger difference. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, there were other supports in place, but those were ones that included my village. The moms I was meeting, one in particular, whose kiddo was maybe 4 weeks ahead in age, maybe 6 weeks ahead. And she was very attachment oriented as a parent. She had done her research on baby needs and the developmental and biological unfolding of development just on her own. She was a Montessori preschool teacher, very in tune with trying to understand children on a deep level. And she was instrumental in me getting through those early months because she was the one that would invite me over. I'd walk to her house with the baby or take the streetcar and she'd have the coffee ready. And it just felt like when I was with her, in addition to unlimited cups of coffee that I didn't have to brew myself, I was able to not be obsessed about sleep when I was there because we were focused on other things. It got me out of my head and into my body and a bit more present with my baby because I wasn't home alone, faced with a sleepless day and a fussy baby after a sleepless night and a fussy baby.
Right. All right. Well, this is great background for us to understand sort of how you got into this and your experiences. And what I want to do is I want to move forward now into, because of this experience you had with this other mom, what types of things, because you're working with clients, what types of things your clients see and what types of issues they have or concerns that our audience could learn more about so they don't have the same things. But before you answer that question, we've got to take a break. So we will be right back in just a minute on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Good. Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking with Heather Boyd. And we left off with a question about what new parents should sort of expect. What types of issues do they come to you with, and what should they know about a new baby and sleep?
Yes. Oh, this is a great question, Andrew, because I think there's kind of two main sides to this. And one is to understand what normal infant sleep development looks like. Because those messages that we get about sleeping through the night and about this being our job to teach sleep, and I'll side trip that with We forget that sleep is developmental. We treat it like a taught skill, like writing, and it's more like walking. It's more like walking in the way that a baby's brain is designed to develop towards taking those first steps. We may revel in teaching our kids to walk, but we're not actually the ones teaching them. We are providing the environment for them to do what they have always done, babies have always done, which is wanting to pull up, wanting to make their way in the world, take those steps. Sure, we delight and revel in it, but we aren't the reason that they walk. Uh-huh. The same with sleep, that it's as their brain and nervous system develops, sleep can mature to be longer sleep cycles, deeper sleep, linking sleep cycles, like coming out of sleep and then coming back into another sleep cycle. This is all brain science. This is how it unfolds naturally. The biggest challenge with sleep is it's also much more impacted by environment than, say, walking is. You don't need a coffee table to learn to walk. You don't need a couch to learn to walk. If it's there, babies will use it, but right, they'll walk anyway. With sleeping, they need to feel safe and secure because a calm nervous system is required to drop into sleep. They need to be fed so that hunger isn't what, I mean, they are going to wake up hungry often in those early months.
Right.
But walking isn't related to whether they just ate or not, but sleeping can be. The safety piece is the big thing. And so when I look at what is it that parents need to know to help sleep unfold as it should, part of it is that by understanding how it unfolds, half of what parents, maybe even more than half of what parents are worried about or think they're responsible for with sleep gets taken off the plate. If sleep were a big dinner plate, we're taking half the meal off. That part is totally up to your baby's maturation. It will unfold as it should. The parent's responsibility is that environment, that ability to create conditions that invite sleep. I've mentioned that it's a lot about nervous system safety. That's a big part of it. But the part that parents mainly know about are a quiet space, consistency, low light, not screens or sunshine pouring in the evening. Those are the physical environment pieces. Those are like sleep hygiene pieces around routine and rhythm. Those are the ones parents tend to be aware of, but they're not aware of just how important that safety and security for the nervous system is. And a big part of that comes through attachment and security. And a big part of that then is unlearning what we think we know about our job in teaching or training sleep. Because training sleep is much more about teaching babies to fall asleep in our absence, when really their nervous system is wanting our presence. Huh. And so with parents, I'm talking often about this push and pull. Parents want more independence. Babies want more closeness. And so right off the get-go, you have this irreconcilable difference in priorities. And when I can help parents realize that that connection piece is what helps the nervous system relax into sleep and allows their brain wiring, those neurons, to wire in a way that lets them know what it feels like to be calm, then when they are ready, they won't need that parent there because that cup is full and overflowing, and developmentally they're ready to take on that piece on their own. Parents think they can rush that part and make a beeline to independent sleep, but it's like a slow walk up the mountain. We can't get to Mount Everest in a day. We've got to take one step at a time.
Right.
So that's the developmental and attachment-based piece. The other part that I think comes up often with my families, once we've had an understanding of how this unfolds naturally, is the health barriers or other barriers that get in the way of that. And I always describe that as being like boulders that are in the way of that path up the mountain. You know, if that peak of Mount Everest is sleeping through the night and not asking for 20 glasses of water when they're three and getting up and saying that they want to play instead of sleep, if that's the pinnacle and we're making our way up the path to the top of the mountain as development unfolds, when there is a boulder in the path, we can't get around it, can't go over it. We have to move it out of the way. And some of those boulders are, like with my son, reflux, where it doesn't matter how his development is unfolding. He can't get past this boulder of reflux because it's pain that's waking him up. Other boulders that get in the way can be airway, so sleep apnea for babies, stuffiness or teething that in the short run can impact sleep as well. Nutritional deficiencies like iron, selenium, magnesium, when those are low, sleep can be really restless. And so when I work with a parent, although the first step is to look at development, when I see some signs of the boulders that are in that way of getting up that mountain to sleeping through the night, we need to move those. We need to assess and address for those things so that we can move those out of the way. They are not every baby, and not every baby has those challenges. And a lot of parents that are really worried about sleep have this worry that something is inherently wrong with their baby's sleep. Most of the time, that's not the case. Most of the time, it is development unfolding in its own timeline. It's particular personality or temperament or sensory traits of that baby that need to be met. Most of the time, it's not health issues. Though I do get a fair share, obviously, because parents are coming to me because sleep is not feeling very well. And those parents include babies that have some of those boulders that are in the way.
Right. Well, before we get too far past it, you were first talking about in the first part, attachment issues and sleep and what the baby needs versus what the parent needs. So can you give a couple examples of what does it actually look like? And here's what I mean. So obviously the parents are probably pretty exhausted, really would love to have, some sleep, have the baby be a little bit more independent. The baby is looking for attachment, comfort, safety, all the things that you were mentioning. So when you work with a client, what do you kind of coach them on? What should it look like for a proper attachment, but also proper, you know, freedom?
Yes. So when I'm working with a family and we're looking at really understanding why sleep looks the way it does right now, some of my attention is on helping parents get rid of what that template in their head of what sleep looks like and look at what their baby needs instead. Because invariably, their baby will need at least some of what would naturally be unfolding with sleep development. But then the rest is, who is your baby and what do they need and how do we give it to them as easily as possible without the parent unraveling? We can't negotiate baby need. It is what it is. But we can figure out, how do we not fight against that need and try to make it go away, which takes a lot of energy, right? That's where the sleep training comes in, where parents will say, I tried it and it did not work for my baby. And we delve into temperament and think, yeah, you have a real feisty baby, very persistent, very highly sensitive. This intuitively, you knew it wasn't going to work and it didn't. And so understanding who that baby is really, really valuable, because within that, you're going to see the development of sleep. You're going to see how temperament and personality traits impact that baby. You're also going to see that everybody, not everybody needs the same amount of sleep, and babies are the same as well. Some babies are really high sleep needs. Some are very low sleep needs. And when parents are looking at these averages or these sleep schedule templates online, those templates are very generic and they don't account for individuality. So when parents start to look, like, get rid of all the messages you have, all those templates and schedules from online, and I'll say to them, look at your baby for the answer. Just look at your baby to figure out what it is that they're telling you they need. They haven't read the book. I wish my son had read the book, but they haven't. And so if they haven't read the book, then you don't need to read the book either. You need to read your baby. So the more that we understand, what are your baby's sleep needs? Are they higher or lower than average? Are we trying to, I always describe it as being like a lemon, that we're trying to squeeze the juice out of it. And the juice is how much sleep your baby needs. And sometimes parents are squeezing so hard to get more juice out because they would love an hour or two in the evening with their spouse, or they want to be able to sleep in past 6 a.m. But we're looking at the numbers saying, okay, your baby is waking up happy. They're quick to settle. There's some consistency in their schedule starting to arise, not because of the parents, but because it's normal over the course of development for that consistency and that circadian rhythm to start kicking in. Mm-hmm. So we can't squeeze more sleep. Even during the day, we're going to be stealing it from night. Or if you're trying to get 12 hours at night, they're not going to make it because they're going to have been filled up with sleep and awake for 2 hours in the middle. Right. So it really is, I think, about understanding the baby that's right in front of you.
So let's kind of put that into real world for a second. It's a tongue twister. So you're a mom of three. You described the issues you had with your first baby. Of the three, were they all similar? Were they all very different? What? Tell us more about how that worked.
They were wildly different. It was and I always say this to parents that come to me when they have more than one kiddo, especially when the first one slept like a dream. And I can guarantee you, when the first one sleeps like a dream, parents own it. They're like, we are great parents. We did something wonderful. And the parents that have sleepless babies like mine think, what have I done wrong? I've really royally messed up my baby. I broke them. I broke them. When really it was just inherently, that is what your kiddo was showing up with. My second kiddo, by this point, I had fully embraced what it meant to take an attachment lens to meet my baby's need for high touch, high proximity. He was highly alarmed. He needed a lot of physical contact, a lot of closeness, and a lot of reassurance to sleep. My second kiddo was the opposite. He would wake up and not be screaming. And this threw me off. My spouse and I would look at this baby that was content to just open his eyes and look around. And it was, if this were a skit on Saturday Night Live, I can just picture it, us going, what do we do now? Like, what do we need now? He needed nothing other than to be there looking at the world, because he was a different temperament, different relationship with sleep, didn't have reflux, and so wildly different. And so when I work with parents like that, who often, again, it's flipped. They have a great sleeper, you know, that is sleeping more than average, and they think they've done such a good job. And then they come to me saying, I don't know what has happened. I tell them that having two children who are different is such a both a wake-up call and a gift to realize you're as important as your parenting is, as important as environment is. Your baby is coming with their own individuality and own sleep needs. And when you have two, and invariably they are different, like I have yet to meet a family that has two kids that are born one after the other that are the same. It's a gift because it reminds you of what you're in control of and what you don't have control over. You don't have control over how it is your baby's going to show up in the world. And at first, for families, because most of us love to have control, we want things to work a certain way. We want our babies to sleep at a certain time. But when that nut gets cracked wide open because you cannot do anything about it, it actually, when I can help families kind of turn that corner, it relieves so much stress and so much burden, because they now know what their job is. Their job is to show up to meet the need of the baby that's in front of them. Their job is not to mold this like clay and make it look a certain way. And that, when parents can get there, can get around that corner, can relieve a lot of what I call the energy leaks, like a tire that has a big leak in it, and they're just leaking energy trying to change things that are not in their control. And instead, we can patch up that leak, let that be baby's domain. That is up to baby. You're just there to hold it. You're there as a container to hold that baby's needs. And that can come with a huge sense of relief for parents.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, let me stop us there for our next break. But when we come back from our break, let's talk a little bit about some common misconceptions and the concept of routines. So we will be back in just a minute on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, aunt and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Heather Boyd, an occupational therapist and an infant and family sleep specialist. So we talked a lot about issues and things that, and how babies are so different and, you know, paying attention to the actual baby's needs themselves. So are there any sort of common misconceptions that parents have that we haven't talked about and that they should be aware of?
Well, I'd love to hit on the idea of routines and rhythms and schedules, because it is one of the things I think we cling to as parents early on, until we either have a very adaptable baby who's like, sure, I'll go along with whatever, I'm fine. Those are not the clients I see. Those babies are so malleable that parents are doing generally just fine. But the misconception is that parents are in charge of making a rhythm or routine for their baby's sleep. And although parents influence it, and parents are in charge of creating that environment for an invitation to sleep, it really is more that parents are the bookends or the container, and it's the baby's neurological development that is creating that rhythm. When babies are born, they have no circadian rhythm. You can't measure melatonin in their blood. They get a little bit from in utero. That gets used up, and it's hard to measure it until they're 3 months old, which is usually when those light bulbs are going on. Baby's kind of waking up to the world, and most of their sleep is starting to consolidate at night. But these are things that are coming neurophysiologically from the baby, partly because of environmental cues, because parents will sleep more at night. The lights are dark. The sun goes down. It really is, I always picture it as being like, parents are those bookends, and it's the baby's development that's filling in the space in between those bookends. And as their nervous system is developing, and as that melatonin starts to course through their veins in the evening to draw them into sleep, and as cortisol starts rising in the morning to start their day, that routine and rhythm will start to emerge on its own. So we go from sleep being dispersed evenly over an entire 24 hours to a JK student whose sleep is almost all at night. Now, how do we get from one to the other? It's, again, partly environmental, partly the parents shaping things over time, but largely it's that that nervous system, that nervous system is mature enough to actually have sleep cycles that are getting longer, more predictability, more sleep at night than during the day. And so when it comes to the myth of like how much of that schedule or routine should parents follow, I always, again, get parents to draw their attention to their child. Look at the cues that they're showing for tiredness. Are we aware of the cues early enough that we can start a bedtime routine and kind of land at bedtime when there's enough sleep pressure and when circadian rhythm is making it easy so that bedtime is as smooth as it can be? I'm not saying it's entirely smooth. There are so many factors that can get in the way of that. But when we can look at what the baby is giving us, we can align with it much better.
So then let's talk a little bit about sleep training. So how does sleep training fit into the big picture with all of these things that you've shared now?
With sleep training, what it's generally doing is treating sleep like a behavior instead of a developmental milestone. Excuse me. And so when we are trying to sleep train, we have a picture of what we want it to look like. And we're trying to make our baby fit into that schedule instead of adapting our expectations to what the baby can do. And so when we can look at sleep training as being behavioral, we're ignoring the developmental process, the nervous system development, the temperament, and the sensory system. When we ignore that, if we have a very malleable baby, flexible, low-key, chill, they're probably pretty adaptable to any schedule a parent tries. Okay. When we, however, have a highly intense, highly sensitive, persistent, or stubborn baby, we end up in loggerheads against them, trying to make them fit into what we want. So it's like a square peg in a round hole, or whatever that expression is. And we end up using a lot of energy trying to make our babies fit something that they can't, because biologically or neurophysiologically, it's just not a good fit. So when I work with families, I don't take a sleep training approach. I take a sleep development approach. And it's about looking at, what does our baby need right now to sleep as well as they can at this point in time? Knowing that when we can meet the need, it really allows independence to emerge on the timeline that fits for that baby, versus sleep training, which is saying, we want your independent sleep to happen on our timeline, regardless of nervous system development or temperament. And so the sleep training piece, it's challenging, because the narrative, when I became a parent, I thought it was my job to sleep train, and that if I did not sleep train, I was failing at one of the first jobs I had as a mom. But the more I understood what sleep development looked like and what attachment looked like and why attachment was important to allowing sleep to unfold, the more I realized, especially with my firstborn, if I tried too hard to make him fit, it wasn't, we were both going to be crying. We were both going to be sleeping and upset and tears.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, what I'm picturing in my brain right now is, when I talk with adults about their own sleep, especially nowadays that we have these electronic sleep trackers and things that people wear, I picture people who are, you know, okay, here's the format that I'm supposed to follow. And I'm supposed to, you know, they believe I'm supposed to sleep 8 hours a night, and I have to, you know, get into bed at this point. I've got to do these things. And I can imagine that carrying over to a baby. It's like, okay, here's the parameters of what a baby should do. If it's not going exactly the way I have it written down on the paper, then something's got to be wrong. And that's just not the case, based on everything that I hear you saying.
Yes, I do get a fair share of parents using Huckleberry app or some other app. And there are a small portion of my clients for whom that Huckleberry app is the bomb. Like, it's like it's telepathically telling them exactly when their baby needs to sleep, and it's working. And I say, if it's working, keep using it. It's great. But for a large number of the clients that I work with, their baby isn't as predictable, isn't lining up with that, and it's causing a lot of anxiety. They're trying to make sense of this data that isn't helping them understand the baby. So it's kind of like in hospitals, when instead of looking at the patient and seeing, gosh, they look a little ashen, they're not looking very well, instead of looking at the patient, if doctors or nurses are only looking at the little blips on the machine, they're going to be missing some really important data about that patient. Same with babies. And so for a large number of my families, the app that tracks sleep is usually a sign of just how anxious they are about sleep versus a usable set of data that's going to help them. Now, letting go of that data is hard, because we've got human brains that love looking for patterns. Patterns require data. And if that app can give us that data and tell us what to do, we'll have less decision fatigue. Maybe we'll be less anxious, although that's not my experience generally. But the other big challenge with those apps is that it will discount sleep in the middle of the night for those routine wake-ups that baby comes out of sleep, gets nursed back to sleep, or gets a bottle, or gets a 10-minute rock back to sleep. And so Huckleberry and other apps will subtract that from total sleep, when really that is very developmentally normal. So one of the first things that I help parents do, if they are using that app and they're not ready to let it go, is to ignore those subtractions. Like, look at when they went to bed, when they got up. That is the total sleep at night, unless they're awake for a substantial amount of time. And right. At that point, if they're awake for a substantial amount of time, we're looking at a split night. Like, they're awake for an hour or two. They're happy as all heck. They're acting like it's 2 in the afternoon. And then we're looking more at that lemon. Again, are we squeezing too much sleep? So at 2 in the morning, they're ready for the day. And then they have their first nap at 4 in the morning until 6 or 6:30. And so it really is about balancing the information you need to have to make wise decisions about the things as a parent you actually have control over versus getting a deeper understanding of what your baby needs so that you can meet those needs as easily as possible.
Right, right. Perfect. Okay, so we have about 1 minute for this last question. And the last question is, are there some practical, easy ways that parents can make sleep easier, things that they can implement after listening to this show?
Okay, I've got two that I'll cover in less than a minute. Okay. The first practical one is do the thing that works. I have so many parents that fight against the thing that actually works because they're told they're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to feed your baby in the middle of the night, or you're not supposed to rock them, or we're not going to touch on safe bed sharing in less than a minute, but for parents that are researching and able to provide safe bed sharing, you know, following James McKenna's advice on that, do what's working and is safe, and don't fight too hard against that just because of that narrative. So that takes care of part of that. The other is, and this is a simple thing that can apply to any age, look at the sensory ways that help your baby feel calm. So senses are like, what do they see, hear, touch, movement, smell, and taste. Taste would be with nursing or with a bottle. Can you incorporate any of those senses in a way that helps the nervous system regulate? It's why we rock babies. It's why there are so many parents bouncing on a ball. It's why babies will often smell better if they have something in their crib that smells like you, because that scent means safety. I have one parent that ended up using dad's deodorant because dad could get baby to sleep really easily. So she thought she would give it a try, and it worked. I've never had another client try it, but look for the sensory ways that make your baby sleep well. And those will continue to change over time, but it's a great place to start.
Fantastic. Well, we've got to wrap up there because we're out of time, but this has been Heather Boyd. Thank you so much for all of the stories and the information and helping us, you know, just better understand what to expect with a new baby and new sleep.
It's been a pleasure, Andrew. Thank you.
Thank you. So for those of you listening, if you want to hear this and other episodes and you want to see it, you can see our YouTube channel or you can listen on any of your favorite podcast networks. Join us at sleepsciencetoday.com where you can find access to all those. And we look forward to seeing you on a future episode of Sleep Science Today.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.